The next case is 03-2116 and 03-2183, Deborah Carnes versus Barrett Kemp.
Thank you.
Mr. Bonar.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, may it please the court, my name is Byron Bonar, and I represent one of the appellants in this case, Jessica Schaefer. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, and the remaining time I'd like to divide with Ms. Rye, who's with the Solicitor's Office of the Ohio Attorney General. I believe I would get 7 minutes.
Let me make sure I understand. I couldn't hear you too well. You might speak into the microphone.
Oh, I'm
there.
Sorry.
You're going to save some time for Ms. Bry.
Yes.
Is she going to take rebuttal, or are you going to take rebuttal?
I will take rebuttal, I believe, unless
okay,
I
you
use
need
all
to
my
watch
time.
Your clock to save time for her.
Sure. I believe I would have initially 7 minutes, and I believe she would have 5. This case is about a daughter who is seeking from her father what every child is entitled, adequate financial support. And the law in Ohio would support her claim. The issue in this case is whether a court has subject matter jurisdiction to award retroactive child support in a paternity action filed after the child reaches the age of majority, but before the child turns 23, which is when the statute of limitations in a paternity action runs. The facts in this case is Jessica Schaefer is the non-marital child of Ms. Carnes and Mr. Kemp. She was abandoned by her father during her childhood, and even though Mr. Kemp knew that she was her child, her father paid her absolutely no support during her childhood, and except for one time, he never visited her. First, the issue of impari materia. The doctrine of impari materia states that statutes pertaining to the same subject matter should be read together. And we are saying
Counsel,
that—
Counsel, do we only get to the conclusion you want by reading impari materia? Because the statute clearly only addresses the issue of establishing paternity, does it not? The statute does not say paternity and child support.
That's correct, but
so you're arguing that we have to read other statutes and public policy and all sorts of other things to get to where you want to go.
Well, I think that's correct. What we're saying is that 3111.05 is not a remedial statute, and it's not a jurisdictional statute. 3111.05 and 3111.06 and 3111.13 were enacted at the same time. They were part of the same uniform law. They were a part of the Ohio's enactment of the Uniform Parentage Act. And 3111.05 was the statute of limitations that was enacted as part of the Ohio's enactment of the Uniform Parentage Act. And incidentally, that statute cannot be read by itself because that is not a grant of jurisdiction. The grant of jurisdiction is in 3111.06. 3111.06 is an independent grant of jurisdictional authority for the Uniform Parentage Act. Those two sections have to be read together. Otherwise, there's no jurisdiction. The 3111.13 is the remedial statute, which provides the remedies after the parent-child relationship is established. Let me also say that 3111.06 is an independent grant of jurisdictional authority. It's independent of any other grant for the juvenile court, and it's also an independent grant for the Common Pleas Court. Or the Domestic Relations Division of the Common Pleas Court to hear paternity cases as well. It's also important to look at the exact language of 3111.06, which says that an action authorized under sections 3111.01 to 3111.18 of the Ohio Revised Code must be brought together, must be brought in the juvenile court. In other words, 3111.06 refers to all of these sections, and certainly there's an intent on the by the legislature to read these statutes together. 3111.13 is entitled Judgments or Orders. This section provides the remedies for the Uniform Parentage Act. And it states what remedies are available after the entry of judgment. Among other remedies that are provided for in 3111.13 is back support. And reading these together, the statute of limitations is at 23. The juvenile court has jurisdiction, and retroactive support is authorized. The second issue I'd like to talk about is Ohio's enactment of the Uniform Parentage Act is a remedial statute, and it is entitled to liberal interpretation. Ohio Revised Code 1.11 states that remedial laws and all proceedings under them shall be liberally construed in order to promote their object and assist parties in obtaining justice. The rule of the common law that states that that statutes in derogation of the common law must be strictly construed has no application to remedial laws. This is not a new doctrine of statutory construction, and it's not unique to Ohio. This is an accepted doctrine of statutory construction, and it was applied in Ohio cases in the 1800s, and it's generally accepted throughout the United States. Remedial laws are laws which provide a remedy or procedures for already existing rights, and that's exactly what Ohio's enactment of the Uniform Parentage Act did. It was a law that enacted remedies and procedures for children who already had, for non-marital children who already had a right to enforce their right to support from their biological father. I would like to reserve the remaining time that I have for Ms. Bry initially, and then what time I would have left, I'll save for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Booner. Ms. Bry.
May it please the court, my name is Diane Bry, here for the Attorney General. I'd like to start by adding a few comments to respond to the question that Justice Stratton raised a few moments ago. Namely, whether you have to look at in pari materia here. There are three statutes you need to read together in this case. There's the Parentage Action Jurisdiction Statute, the 23-year statute of limitations, and also the Parentage Action Remedy Statute, which Mr. Bonar just alluded to and talked about the statutes providing a remedy of child support in the usual case. From those statutes, several premises follow. First of all, no one disputes that in the ordinary case, anyone filing a parentage action can get child support as one of the remedies. Second, it can't be disputed that the General Assembly here extended the statute of limitations to file a parentage action to 23 years after the birth of the child. So from that, when a child between the ages of 18 and 22 timely files a parentage action within the statute of limitations, it follows that she may seek retroactive child support as a remedy in that action. After all, why would the General Assembly have extended the statute of limitations to 23 years if it intended to prohibit a young adult from seeking
There are lots
child
of reasons.
Support?
I mean, you could, you know, you've got inheritance issues, you've got all sorts of issues like that that you may want to be establishing after the age of 18 that this parenting statute allows you to establish. But I have a hard time reading into this the right to continue to file for child support after age 18 when kids after 18 don't get child support anymore unless they're still in school for another year. Why is this child put in a different position than any ordinary child who has both parents declared has no right to further child support once they turn 18?
The difference, Your Honor, here is that this child did not have her father fulfill his duty of supporting her during her minority from the time of birth to 18, and that also is not in dispute here. everyone would agree that...
Was she on welfare the entire time?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe she was the whole time, but for intermittent periods, it's my understanding she was.
So would some of that money go to reimbursement of what she received from welfare rather than going to her?
That would certainly, under the law, we would think in many cases that would be so. In this case, just because of the procedural posture of that issue having been determined adversely by the trial court and not having been appealed, it's not at issue here.
Okay.
But certainly the state has an interest in the welfare assignment, seeing as all the members of the assistance group would have assigned their rights to any support payments that would come in.
In fact, I had that same question, because it seems to me this our decision in this case will have an impact on whether the public pays for or is reimbursed through the welfare agency. The Child Support Enforcement Agency is included in the entry of the trial court and of the Court of Appeals, which I guess looks to me as if the support agency, the payments are to be made to the young woman here through the support agency. Is that because they're, do we know what? I couldn't tell, just Justice Resnick's question, I couldn't tell either whether there had been welfare provided here or whether the mother provided all of the support for her daughter, for Jessica, during this period of time when the father was in Texas or wherever he was. Do we know that from the record?
I believe in the trial court's entry that there was some reference to that, but not as to a specific amount. I'd have to say that I'm not aware that is in the record as to an apportionment. Mother paid this. The state, through the welfare agency, paid a certain amount, but there was some assistance as well.
Do you agree that our decision here would have the same effect if Jessica had been supported entirely from welfare benefits during this period of time? In other words, put whatever the welfare agency is in the county as the plaintiff. Would our ruling on the law here have the same impact? In other words, that the county agency then would receive reimbursement essentially for what it paid, the support it paid because the father and mother did not support the child, Jessica?
If I understand Your Honor's question, in other words, if we had a different procedural posture than we have here, and you have the welfare agency able to present this claim, then yes, I think the state through the welfare agency would have a right when those support payments came in to have that whatever amount it was determined that they were entitled to come to them in that instance because of the assistance that was paid. But again, that in this particular case, that doesn't come up as an issue because of the procedural posture. Here we're talking about Jessica's
counsel
claim.
Based on some of the previous questions asked, there's the perception that, you know, at 18, the child is no longer entitled to support from the parents. In reality, a decision here in favor of Ms. Carnes does not give her anything more than what she would have been entitled to. She's only asking for support up until the age of 18. She's not asking for reimbursement for any expenses from 18 to 23 or however old she is at this point. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. There is no claim here for an award of current or future support. This is solely for back support. And in fact, that's what the trial court found, that $52,000 amount was for support that would have been owed from the time she was born until the time she was 18.
And was that figured based on the earnings of her father?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. It was, as I understand it, it was using the formulas that were in existence through the relevant time periods to come up
given
with the appropriate
Given the fact
support.
That he was gainfully employed for all these years during her 18 years of minority.
Yes, well, certainly the formula took into account his employment at the various times and what the formula amount for support would have been. So, yes, it is a backward-looking remedy. It is not for current or future support after the child is 18.
And let me draw your attention to Revised Code 3111.13C, which I believe opposing counsel argues that it sets a F2, seems to tie back support to a current support order And since there is no possibility of a current support order, given her age, the argument would be that there is no opportunity then to secure retroactive child support. How would you address that?
Your Honor, to respond to that point, the F2 section of that statute does talk in terms of an order that's incident to a current support. Our position is that it simply doesn't apply for that reason. This is a situation where there will be no opportunity for current support, of course, because Jessica is over 18, and so that limitation doesn't apply. However, if you look at F3, interestingly enough, there they specifically, the General Assembly specifically says, this is when you can't have a retroactive support, and again, from the current support, but when the child is over 3 and the father hasn't known of the child's existence or hasn't had reason to know up until that point. Certainly they looked at it and thought that was a situation where we don't want to have retroactive support, but they did not preclude it here.
So the fact that there is no potential for current support or prospective support, you think needs to just be eliminated from F2 and allow then for the establishment of retroactive support?
Yes, Your Honor. We think that 3111.13c, which is the general remedies provision, talks about incident to a determination of paternity. You have many things that you can have in that order, and one of them is support. And so, yes, we think that provides the authority here to provide a retroactive order of support when the court makes the determination of paternity. It's one cause of action in the parentage action, and when that action is timely filed under the 23-year statute of limitations, we believe that the retroactive child support is something that can be awarded. I think it bears mentioning, though, to respond to some of the...
But since the legislature extended it to 23, it would appear that they were contemplating that retroactive child support could be awarded. I mean, they could have cut it off at 18, but they extended the period. As in this case, the parent didn't see fit, the mother didn't see fit to file a paternity action, and that takes away the rights of the child. We have many, many cases where we allow a child to bring an action after they reach majority, and it appears that the legislature intended that to happen in this case, so the child could be reimbursed from a father. So in my opinion, it appears that the statute does imply that you can collect retroactive child support.
We would certainly agree with Your Honor. We think that the 23-year statute of limitations is there for a reason. Certainly there are other there could be other emotional reasons. There could be perhaps inheritance, although, as we point out in our brief, somebody who just lost a paternity action could write a will to avoid that. There may be some other tangential reasons, but because the ordinary remedy in a parentage action is child support, we think the General Assembly contemplated that that remedy would be available in a case such as this, where a child timely brings the paternity action within the 23-year statute of limitations. Otherwise, as Your Honor points out, the child would not have that right at all, because once she turned 18, then she would have no right to enforce the duty of support, because somebody else, presumably earlier on, made a determination that they didn't want to enforce that right. So,
future time.
Thank you, Your Honor. For all the reasons in our briefs, we urge the court to reverse the court below, answer the certified question in the affirmative. Thank you.
Mr. Cotterdam.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Court Cotterdam, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Barrett Kemp II. It is our position that a juvenile court is a court of special and limited jurisdiction, which has no subject matter jurisdiction to determine an order of child support after a person has reached the age of majority. The case of Clark versus Alleman indicates that jurisdiction of limited courts must be strictly construed and cannot be enlarged by liberal construction language.
Well, the General Assembly said in 3111.13c that one of the pieces of jurisdiction, I guess, the trial court has is concerning the duty of support. I know you've argued why that doesn't apply here, but tell me why it does not apply here.
I think if you look at the statute itself, it uses the word child, and it uses the words best interests of the child. And then what the statute and what the legislature had in mind is various remedies. It says if the court issues an order for support, then the non-custodial parent has various rights, residential parenthood, visitation, various other remedies. Those remedies don't apply when a child becomes an adult. Therefore, we know the legislature had contemplated child support and decided no, paternity between 18 and 23, but not child support. If not, they would have had to change the entire statute, the entire C statute. C discusses remedies for a child. Jessica Schaefer was not a child when she filed this action. She is not entitled to child support as an adult. That's what the legislature, it presupposes that the order was issued during minority. And when you move on to 3111.13f, the juvenile court makes a determination of past support when it's making a determination of current support. That's the legislative intent. Well, we know that you can't make a determination of current support for an adult. So the legislature, if they wanted in this 18 to 23 year period to allow child support, they would have had to change the F section also. All of the statutes speak to child. And we know when
Counsel, what is the reason then to extend it to 23? There's other vehicles for establishing paternity. The probate court, for example, if you have issues of inheritance, you want to have a voluntary establishment of paternity, and you use that for benefits, Social Security, et cetera, you know, and that's done in the probate court, and it's a non-adversarial proceeting.
Correct.
All right. Now we have the what is could be either a consensual or an adversarial proceeding in juvenile court, done when the child is a minor.
Correct.
Or when before the child is 23, pursuant to statute.
Yes, I would agree that why that remedy was chosen in the juvenile court, I don't know.
Because it's tied to the support obligation, whereas the probate vehicle for establishing child support, or for establishing paternity, has no support obligation with it.
But
whereas domestic and juvenile are tied to the flow of dollars for the support of the child.
3111.05 is the statute of limitations section, and it does not provide for child support. It provides for an additional 5 years to determine paternity, and for the reasons you indicated and Justice Stratton indicated, there may be reasons to establish paternity. The benefits, inheritance, getting to know who the family is, Social Security. But not for child support. The legislature could very easily have put a sentence in there that all those rights and remedies apply to this adult, but they continue to use the language child. Therefore, when a non-child files an action for paternity, we must assume that the legislature did not intend for that adult to obtain child support. Child support, the theory behind it is to allow the child to have the necessities of life and support during childhood. I hate to use the term from the Court of Appeals decision, but they're not entitled to the cash. And that's essentially what Jessica Schaefer was asking for in this case. It would be her mother or the Child Support Enforcement Agency who provided support. So she would not be entitled to this money that the trial court provided for her in this case.
So since another entity stepped up to the plate.
Since another entity stepped up to the plate and provided for this young lady during her minority, and your client ignored his responsibility as a father, he should continue to ignore that responsibility once paternity is established, is that correct?
No, not from a moral perspective. From a legal perspective, there was a number of different ways that Jessica Schaefer's mother and all the agencies that have come to her aid in this case could have filed for child support, but did not.
All right, and I read that part of your brief and took particular interest in it when the mother had a duty to find him and sue for support. What about his duty, knowing that he had fathered a child, to establish paternity in juvenile court, through the same means that were available to the mother and become a part of this child's life, both physically and through support. Why is it the mother's burden here to do this and not the father's responsibility?
Because
and as a result of him not following through with that responsibility, walking away from the fiscal responsibility as well.
Because the legislature has for years said that child support is to be enforced during childhood. If they filed the action and he was required to appear and an amount was established, we wouldn't be here today. It's during that period of time.
If who would have filed the action?
If the child support, well, from the record in this case, Jessica Schaefer indicates she just did an internet search one day and found her dad, and then went and contacted the Child Support Enforcement Agency. There are a lot of times when part of the problem is the mother may not want the father in the child's life, and in exchange for not having the father around, gives up that argument to have support. There are a lot of different reasons why this happens.
And the ineffectiveness of the Child Support Enforcement Agency in the many counties over the last 20 years is also an example or a rationale for this coming at a late date. But that, none of that matters. None of that matters to what we're here to decide today as whose fault, who should have filed, why they didn't file, what the motivation was, including, I'm presuming your position would be, your client's failure to step up and have himself declared as the father of this child and come forth with support.
From a moral perspective, certainly, but I think we're here today to determine after a child reaches majority, does an adult, that child's non-custodial parent, have a legal duty to pay back support? And the legislature has not so said. And until the legislature goes back and looks at this and decides we better put some language in there to clarify it and change all these statutes that say child, I don't think that this court can read into that.
Is child here meant to infer a relationship between the individual who is in essence a child and the parent as opposed to minority-majority distinction?
I read that argument in one of the reply briefs, but I would submit that the language of the statute, which defines child, specifically indicates all persons of 18 or more who are under no disability are capable of contracting or of full age. There's a number of definitions that seem to suggest, no, it's a linear age. 18 years of age, you become an adult. And I want to also point out one other thing. The legislature knows when to create exceptions. There are three exceptions that we found to the idea that a child becomes an adult at 18. There is an unruly child under 2105. There is also under 3109, and this court affirmed that in the Castle case, when the child has a mental or physical disability and turns 18, there are duties of support. And there is a third time when a child is emancipated and is then in high school, still a full-time student in high school, then the legislature has created an exception there to the normal duties of support. So the legislature did take their time and did consider this issue. And they never once said that, generally speaking, any child who files an action, everyone is entitled to back support between 18 and 23. And I think there are bad policy decisions that could occur if that happens. Certainly it could happen that the mother could support the child could wait till 18 and could tell the child not even to file, just wait till you're 18 and then you get all the back support. How does that promote a family relationship to do things that way? Child support is for the necessities of life during childhood. It's not to get cash once you turn 18. I hate to say it that way, but that's what will happen if this court sides with appellant's arguments.
If no one had provided Jessica with what we would describe as adequate child support during her minority, doesn't her argument that she's entitled to have what would be, I guess, in this case, the additional support that her father was obligated to provide her during her minority, that, I mean, if here we have a situation where the child apparently was fairly well provided for during her minority, despite the father's absence. But we're writing law in this case. We're trying to determine what the General Assembly intends. Should we not consider the situation where a child really is not adequately supported, and now after reaching age 18 files an action for support? Wouldn't that, from a policy standpoint, that would be to be consistent with what the General Assembly is doing with when it gave this longer statute of limitations, wouldn't it?
I understand the thought in doing that, but I would, I guess, refer the court back to the legislature who has made exceptions, and that certainly could be another exception. If the child proves that during the child's youth, he or she was not provided for and did not have support, I'm not sure how you could, in a decision, say, when does that happen? I mean, is it when they got no support? Is it when they got some support? Is it when the mother provided for 6 years but not for the next 12? It's too hard, I think.
Well, why wouldn't that be a discretion of the trial judge? Trial judge has the authority in every other support case to decide what, subject to the guidelines, but to determine the factual situation and what fits the factual situation.
Because I think you'd be going contrary to an unambiguous statute that doesn't need to be read with other statutes. It says that you have an ability to file for parentage between the ages of 18 and 23. It does not say that you have an ability to file for child support between the ages of 18 and 23. There are a lot of reasons why to file for parentage. We must assume the legislature took into account child support and didn't change any of the definitions of child. Didn't refer back to 3105, didn't say, well, you're a child, except you're an adult, except when you file for paternity between the ages of 18 and 23.
Again, can you tell me how the court arrived at the amount of money here, $52,000?
I believe, Your Honor, I was not trial counsel. I believe the parties agreed to that. They stipulated to the amount of that. I think they used some formulas, and I believe it was stipulated between the parties. In the future, I have no idea how a court would come to that amount.
Counsel, who filed this action?
The original action, I believe, was filed by the Child Support Enforcement Agency. The record seems to reveal that.
But the statute doesn't extend it for them, does it?
No, it does not, but I believe they filed it on her behalf, if I'm not mistaken. And I do not believe there was an objection certainly raised, timely objection, to the juvenile court's jurisdiction to hear it, not as to whether or not child support had the ability to.
Another procedural aspect, the Court of Appeals indicates that defense of estoppel or latches, was not pursued in the Court of Appeals. Do you know why?
I think the dissent indicates that it was not, yeah. But I believe even the appellant concedes, although it wasn't raised in a lengthy fashion, it was raised in the last two paragraphs of the brief of the appellant, Mr. Kemp, in the Court of Appeals. So I think it was, and certainly his argument in the trial court was certainly that they knew where he was. There was letters that went back and forth. There was phone numbers. And Jessica Schaefer, by her own testimony, I never tried to establish a relationship with my father because he didn't try to establish one with me. Ms. Carnes, the mother, says, I never sought child support from him. So I think it was raised. Was it raised in a lengthy way? No. I would agree with that, Your Honor. Again, I would just go back to the beginning that a juvenile court is a court of special and limited jurisdiction. Until the legislature gives this court guidance on that, I don't think this court can legislate that decision. Certainly, if this court believes from a policy perspective that it would be warranted for the legislature to do that, certainly that would be appropriate. But the statutes are clear, and there is no reason to change what is written in the statutes until the legislature does that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Goddardam. Mr. Bonar, you've used your time. It may take 30 seconds.
Okay.
Mr. Bonar, let me ask you to change the facts a little bit in this case. Certainly, as Justice Stratton has raised by her question, an extended statute of limitations could be there because a child, unlike his or her mother, wants to be able to say, that's my father. The mother may not have cared and may expressly not even want that to be known. So the child brings an action, but during minority, the child's mother had received some substantial amount of public assistance. Is she in a position, she or he, who may not want to impose child support, just wants paternity established for purposes of their own well-being and state of mind? If they bring this action, does it, the way you would have us write the case, does it axiomatically follow that your agency could come in and enforce child support then?
The statute of limitations is written for all parties. The child support enforcement action can bring this within 23 years. The mother can bring this within 23 years, and the child can bring it within 23 years. if the state legislature had wanted to preclude child support, it could have done that, and certainly did that in the probate court proceeding. 2105.25 and 26. It specifically, they refer to that, but it specifically is a voluntary proceeding, and it specifically provides that child support cannot be awarded. That certainly by implication means that in the juvenile court proceeding, it would be awardable. Jessica Schaefer, in this case, did receive support from her mother, but she is entitled to support from both parents. She's entitled to support from her father as well as her mother. Her life was not that rosy. She was on and off welfare, and her life would have been very different if her father had been paying support. Her mother was poor. Her father was a middle-class man who was wealthy. I forget who asked this question, but I think it was Judge Udall. The way the trial court calculated the child support is the Child Support Enforcement Agency asked in an interrogatory what the father's Social Security wages were during the entire period of this this case. Then using that, the Child Support Enforcement Agency used the child support worksheets that were in existence for each of those years and calculated exactly what the child support should be and should have been during those years. She is not seeking any support currently after 18. It's only the back support that should have been paid that was not that she is seeking.
You've used your time, Mr. Bonner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.